Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at eplroundtable@gmail.com.
Hi everyone, I'm Jamie Smith, head sub at Burnley. I write and edit the No Name Ever newsletter, which goes out every Monday via Substack, and it's free to read, so feel free to subscribe.
Hi everyone, I'm Sam Carp. I'm a Crystal Palace supporter, sometimes write for the Eagles Beak, and you can find me on Twitter, or X if you're calling it that these days, at Sam_Carp.
Hi, I'm Steve McGookin, a Tottenham fan based in Belfast, and in a previous life I was the chairman of the New York Spurs Supporters Club.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining me today, guys. Just a bit note for the folks at home. If I sound a little sleepy or slur my words at all, I got a concussion last night doing yard work. And while the independent review panels in the NFL and Premier League often come into question, I didn't even have one of those to clear me for this podcast. So any slip-ups, please excuse me. Although my wife did try to get me to say the intro to this very show as the sentence she kept trying to get me to say after the incident. Because she's like, you've been saying that for 10 years. Surely you've got this. But anyway, enough about me. Let's get into the show. Obviously, the huge match I'm sure everyone will be talking about was the Arsenal-Manchester City one. So I guess I'll just leave it to you guys. Talk about a little bit what your thoughts were from the match and any overarching takeaways that you've taken away from it.
Yeah, just to kick things off, I don't have a concussion, so there's no excuse for me if I make any mistakes. That's just me being rubbish. I thought it was an interesting game. I often find now that these really top-level matches between the elite sides that are challengers, they more resemble chess than football these days. There's a lot of both defences holding the ball and waiting to see which pawns are going to move and press and then try and go around them. And a lot of the match was basically an arm wrestle with lots of fouls. Not much happened until the end, and Arsenal found a way to win it. I think it was impressive mentality from Arsenal, but I think the key factor in the result was probably Manchester City continuing to miss Rodri. I think it's become clear in the last few weeks when Rodri's been out that he's arguably their most important player now. I rate Rodri very, very highly. I think in his position, he's probably the best in the world for his age. He's an extraordinary talent. You think he's going to continue to get better. Defensive mind and midfielders normally peak later in their careers. So the fact that Rodri's relatively young for that position, I think, is a sign that he's going to dominate that position for a long time. Arsenal obviously missed Bukayo Saka as well. So both teams had a key player out. But I think Rodri is essentially the linchpin for everything that City do. And for all Pep Guardiola's tinkering and plans and deep thinking about the game, he doesn't really have a backup for Rodri. He clearly doesn't trust Calvin Phillips. Bernardo Silva seems to be playing at the back of midfield, which is quite interesting. And City look a bit vulnerable right now. Obviously, Rodri will be back from suspension, but when Rodri's not there, it clearly opens the door for other teams. And going into the international break, it looks like we've got a really good title race on our hands. I think a lot of people thought City won the league 3 years in a row, it's going to be a procession, they'll win it 4 years in a row, but the weakness is there and other teams will be looking at them and see that there's an opportunity there. They've lost to Wolves, they've lost to Newcastle in the Carabao Cup, now they've lost to Arsenal. There's a chance there for something very exciting to happen, particularly if you're a Spurs fan, eh?
I get too carried away, Jamie. but yeah, I mean, I think similar to what you said. I think Peter Drury in the Sky commentary described it as attritional towards the end of the first half, and I think that's definitely what it was for the most part. And he described it as a game of chess, and I sort of understand that. But I actually thought it was a pretty poor game between two sides. It looked like they were quite afraid of losing. You know, this game usually has goals in it. Maybe the fact it didn't on this occasion was owing to the fact that Arsenal have, I think, what was their record? It was something like they hadn't won against City since, I don't want to get this wrong, maybe it was 2018 or something before this. But typically City tend to do the double over them. So perhaps the fact that this game was so attritional owed to the fact that Arsenal were taking a bit of a different approach. And even in that, I thought they gave City a bit too much respect in the first half. And Raya in goal in particular was quite lucky not to be punished for his rather erratic performance. Got closed down by Alvarez at one point, and that could have easily rebounded off of him and gone into the net. But on the other side of that coin, I don't think City really sort of seized on that themselves. I don't think they played with that much purpose, and that kind of allowed Arsenal to grow into the game in the second half. You know, didn't feel like City were winning the ball that hard pitch, didn't feel like they were dominating possession necessarily, and when they did have it, it didn't feel like they were doing too much with it. And that allowed Arsenal in that second half to seize the initiative as the home team and actually threaten the City box a little bit without creating too many clear-cut chances. And you know, on another day, I think this game just peters out and finishes 0-0. But ultimately, you know, the goal that decides it was incredibly fortunate. Obviously, it takes a massive deflection off Ake, which wrong-foots Edison. But I think that was Arsenal's reward ultimately for trying to play a little bit more on the front foot in the second half. For City, I think it was kind of a punishment for what was maybe one of their more negative performances I can remember from them in recent times. And yeah, Jamie, I think, as you say, they massively missed Rodri. It's become quite apparent in the last few games. So yeah, that's kind of the overarching takeaway, I think. But I don't think I've come away from the game thinking that Arsenal were any more title contenders than they were last season. I don't come away from it thinking this result means that Arsenal are going to usurp City and go that one step further. It's obviously good that they've broken their duck against City, and it's good that they've managed to win without some key players. Saka, as you mentioned, Jamie and Martinelli for a half, who came on and made a difference. But you have to imagine that City will improve when Rodri comes back. They've still got De Bruyne to come back in. So you have to imagine that they'll pick it up like they always do. But yeah, my main takeaway is similar to Jamie. I think if you're Liverpool, to a lesser extent Spurs, maybe if we are including them in these conversations now, you're probably feeling quite emboldened after watching that and by City's start to the season. I know it's early days in regards to City, in regards to Spurs, but it does already feel a little bit more open at the top. You know, 3 points between four sides after 8 games. If that continues after the international break, people might start to wonder if City are struggling a little bit for motivation after essentially winning everything they could possibly win and, you know, attaining that unprecedented treble. Well, not unprecedented, but, you know, the treble that they've been chasing for so long last season. So, yeah, I think what it points to is kind of hopefully a much tighter, more exciting title race than we've had over the past few years.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with both of those guys. I didn't watch the game, so you've just given me a pressy of it. But you know, you can't argue with the stats. It's the Arsenal's first win over City in 12 games, and apparently the first time they've beaten them in a Premier League home game without conceding since 2012, which, you know, just shows you that they're learning. They've learned from last season, Arsenal, and I'm not sure I would sort of rule out the idea that they can't go one step further. I actually have a feeling that they will. And in terms of what today's result means, certainly for, you know, Liverpool fans, Spurs fans who were looking at this and thinking, well, this could go any one of three ways. I mean, either of the two teams could win, plus we could end up with a draw, but it doesn't really have a deep impact on, you know, how we all move forward from here. But here's what I think it means in terms of confidence and in terms of establishing a position at the top of the league. Especially, I think, in context of the unexpected inconsistency of United and Ten Hag, and I think this is going to be a really challenging next run of fixtures for City. If you look at their next seven games, I just wrote these down. Is it Brighton, Man U, Bournemouth, Chelsea, Liverpool, Spurs, and Villa? Now, those games, I mean, as a run of seven games coming up for City, that's gonna be a tough ask, I think, for all of those games. And I think it gives Arsenal an opportunity to establish their position as maybe being in a position to you know, go one further than they did last year. So I think by Christmas you could have a situation where Arsenal are again firmly in the driver's seat, and you know, as I say, they will have learned from their experiences last season, and they might not let it slip again the way they did. But certainly competitively, at this stage, one result isn't going to make that much difference. But there was one other takeaway that I did notice, and I'm sure you guys did when I was watching the highlights at the end. The handshake between the two managers I thought was quite interesting and symbolic. It looked like Arteta wanted to make a statement by not acknowledging that there was any kind of relationship, despite the hype and the press coverage all week of that relationship between Pep and Arteta. And obviously there was a lot of hype on that relationship prior to the game. But Arteta's point was that they were equals, and you know, he's more than entitled to do that. And I think this is going to be the new dynamic at the top of the Premier League, and the Pep and Arteta storyline is definitely going to be one that's going to pervade through the rest of the season, because you're looking at, I think, the two main competitors for the title. And also, I mean, another stat was that Arteta has now beaten all 24 clubs that he has faced as Arsenal boss. So, you know, with that, and again, what he has, and his players will have learned from their experience last season, I think things might be shifting.
Sorry, Jamie and Sam. Apparently, Steve not ready to take the bait yet on Tottenham's title charge.
I was going to say let's knock that one on the head, but perhaps in the current circumstances, that's probably not the best thing.
After eight match weeks, best start to a season since '61. Not saying, just saying. So apparently, I'm less able to refuse the lure there set by Jamie and Sam. Moving to something that happened in a different match today. Wolves ended up getting a red card today. And if you are watching the season and you're wondering or feeling like there's infinitely more red cards this season than last, you're not wrong. At this stage last season, there were less than 5 red cards. This year, with today's, there have been 19 red cards shown through 9 weeks, which is the most at this stage since at least 2015, which is far back as the stats go on the site that I was using. Why do you think we've seen such a huge surge in red cards? Because this isn't just a pre-post VAR line. The average was actually higher the 5 years before VAR was implemented in the 2019-20 season than the 5 since, which we are now in the 5th. Just curious why you guys think it's spiking so heavily this year.
Well, I think the start of the season, there always seems to be a new thing that referees are being told to clamp down on. This season, it seems to be dissent and time wasting, and we've seen a lot of cheap yellow cards and some red cards that have followed as a result of this new focus. But you normally get to this sort of stage in the season where a handful of games have been played, we're going into the second international break, and the referees normally just stop doing whatever they've been told to focus on. And get back to normal. I think VAR is still having an impact. Now, I support Burnley. We've had 2 red cards this season already. I don't think anyone who's ever watched Burnley under Vincent Kompany would describe us as a dirty team. We don't normally put any tackles in. And both were given by the VAR. And I think it's an ongoing issue with VAR, isn't it, that they seem to be looking for reasons to punish players, looking for reasons to disallow goals, looking for reasons to send players off. One of our red cards was in the opener where Anas Zanouri's put in a late rash tackle. It was given as a yellow on the pitch and then upgraded to a red. I think most people would have been okay if that had stayed a yellow. I don't think it really needed to be changed. And then one where Lyle Foster's just lost his temper and elbowed someone in the chest that wasn't seen. So you can say that's what VAR's for, right? To see the things that the referees didn't see. But again, it was a bit of a nothing incident, really. It might be that today we've already seen a little bit of rowing back on that. One thing that we didn't mention when we were talking about the Arsenal City game was because Arsenal won anyway, but the fact that Mateo Kovacic was probably quite lucky not to be sent off himself. He had a yellow card for something that could have been a red. Then he had another tackle that looked very much like a yellow card if he hadn't already got a yellow card. It was a bit surprising that Guardiola left him on so long when he was running that risk of being sent off. Kovacic was really quite fortunate, in my opinion. So I think it's a combination of this clampdown on things like dissent and time wasting, the fact that VAR seems to be insisting on re-refereeing things as they happen. And I think everyone really wants to see 11 against 11 in a fair contest as much as possible. So hopefully everyone will calm down a bit after the break and we'll get back to seeing matches where tackling is allowed. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, the coverage this one today was interesting. Like, 100% should have been that. I didn't think that first one quite warranted being overturned. It was one of those ones, I think, that on Sky, they described it as a kind of, you know, just on the borderline of a yellow and a red, and there wasn't enough in it for it to be upgraded, I don't think. But the fact it was stupid enough to go and make an almost identical challenge about 5-10 minutes later, and Michael Oliver dismissed it so soon, sort of straight away, was fairly ridiculous. And also just kind of highlighted further the ridiculousness of VAR and that they can only intervene if it is deemed to be a straight red. I think with those stats, 18 red cards being shown at this stage of the season, it would be interesting to know how many of those have been straight reds, how many have been as a result of two yellows, because as Jamie mentioned, there have been some those new rules that were introduced at the start of the season about players can be booked for surrounding the referee, players can be booked for waving an imaginary card at the referee, for example, the whole clamp down and time wasting, etc. It'd be interesting to see if that has actually had an impact. But then as Jamie alluded to as well, the fact with VAR, it's kind of legacy issues anyway already, in the sense that every challenge slowed down looks worse than it was in real time. I think Curtis Jones's red card last week against Spurs was another example of that. I know that one hasn't, I don't think that one got overturned after their appeal. But yeah, I think that one was quite harsh, and it's always something you're going to have with VAR, is that when those replays are slowed down, they're always going to look worse. And then maybe, I don't know, another thing that could be having an impact is just the fact that the games are longer now. Like, we've got so much more injury time. There's more opportunity for players to pick up those kind of petty yellow cards for time wasting or whatever it may be, and perhaps the fact that the games are so much longer, like players are just making more tired challenges, they may be a little bit later to the ball. So perhaps that, I think that, you know, these are all factors perhaps, but yeah, I mean I personally haven't noticed it too much, to be honest. It hasn't really impacted Palace's games. The only red card in one of our matches was when Tomiyasu was sent off a little bit harshly for Arsenal, and the scoreline didn't change after that. I think Luton maybe have had a couple of opportunities that they haven't taken. I think they played against both Wolves and obviously Spurs this weekend for a large period of the game against 10 men. But for some reason, I don't know, I feel like these incidents tend to happen a lot more in big games between the title challenges or those sort of in the mix for top four, where there are highly charged atmospheres and there's more of a tendency for players to fly into challenges, and unfortunately Palace aren't really involved in a lot of those.
Yeah, I totally agree with the points about the start of the season and the mindset at the start of the season and the resulting excess of petty yellow cards, which inevitably lead to more reds at this point of the season. But I have a feeling that this season will be the end of VAR in its current format. The league, I don't think they'll make a big deal of announcing anything that comes near to scrapping it or anything like that, simply because there's too much invested in it. But I think going beyond the just the goal line alerts now, I think technology has run its course simply because too many managers and players don't think it adds anything positive to the game, but just creates more problems than it solves. So I have a feeling that the authorities are going to have to find a way to alleviate the issues that VAR's encroachment further into the game is causing. And, you know, I as you know, Kev, I was a believer in using technology to the fullest extent that we could, because, you know, I thought that the problems came when the referees didn't have the same view of incidents as viewers at home. And that goes, you know, way back to the Pedro Mendes goal at Old Trafford. And it made sense for everyone to know what was a goal and what wasn't. But then, you know, VAR became something bigger than I think any of us expected. And it has now, I think, outlived its usefulness simply because it continues each week. And of course, I hold my hands up and say the Liverpool game, the Spurs Liverpool game, is a complete example of this. VAR has outlived its usefulness, and I fully expect there to be some kind of recalibration of how it's used within the game, with the intention of generating some greater consistency, and maybe that requires it to be responsible for fewer decisions. But you know, I don't know, but I would expect some kind of bounce back, some kind of pushback against the extent to which VAR now affects outcomes.
Just to jump back in on this, I was reading today in The Guardian that Norway's introduced the AR, and a lot of the clubs are unhappy about it. There's been huge protests in the stands, supporters leaving games, and that's one of the biggest pushbacks that we've really seen in European football. Sweden haven't introduced it. Apparently, they're the only one of Europe's top 30 leagues that hasn't had it. So if Steve's got a point that the tide is sort of turning on VAR, and I think one of the issues is that it's being used so differently to how everyone was told at first that it was going to be used for, like, the clearing, obviously, all that kind of stuff. Now it's used for everything all the time, it seems. So there are parts of Europe where things are in flux regarding VAR. I thought it was kind of here to stay and we were all going to have to get used to it, but maybe there is some hope.
Yep, I hope so. I hope so. I mean, as I say, I think there's too much invested in it. Certainly the Premier League has too much money and credibility invested in it, but they're gradually, with every contentious decision, they're undermining its credibility still further. And the fact that managers and players alike now put no stake in it, it just adds to the pressure for something to give. Maybe it's just a basic simplification of how the system works, that, as you say, we thought we were going to get at the start when it was supposed to be introduced to do away with refereeing error. And now we know that that's not. Referees are fallible, of course they are, and that's a part of the game. But now it's creating more problems than it's solving.
I did like Postecoglou's discussion about people thought that as soon as VAR came in, that all of a sudden everything would be objectively correct, and that suddenly errors wouldn't exist. But it's still people running it, so there will inherently still be errors. Which I know some took as him just trying to pass off the Liverpool goal that led to all that drama. But I do think there's an element of that. It is not ever going to be perfect. And the closer we get to, the more technology that's included, I think he's right, the more people assume that it will be inherently better. And I'm not sure we've seen that thus far. We'll wrap up this opening section talking about managers. In 7 of the last 10 Premier League seasons, at least one manager had been sacked by this point, the second week of October. Are you surprised that no one has been sacked thus far? And do you think we'll start to see one? Because obviously the international breaks are when it's easiest, because you get those 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'm hoping you're not tempting fate with this question, Kev. I think one of the
apologies to any manager that gets sacked, this is on me.
Yeah, it will be completely your fault if this happens. But I think it's partly the three promoted teams have all started really badly, and I think even though there were some Burnley fans expecting us to do really well, I think more broadly speaking, most people thought that they were going to be at the bottom. So they are performing in line with expectations. It's too early for sort of panicking in the hope of inspiring a turnaround there. And all three teams, their managers did incredible work, obviously getting promoted, but in the case of Sheffield United and Luton, really against expectations. So they've got some credit in the bank. Paul Heckingbottom can survive that Newcastle defeat. I don't think he's going anywhere anytime soon. They've obviously had some terrible luck with injuries as well, with Chris Basham, the latest, that terrible, terrible injury over the weekend. So I think those three are going to be fine for a good while. The one that's really under pressure is obviously Bournemouth. I read a lot of things on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, over the summer about how they'd bought all these great players. They had an exciting manager. They were going to be great. They were going to be the neutral's favourite. They haven't won any games, and they've still got Dominic Solanke up front. So I don't know how good they're going to be. They've got relatively new owners, haven't they, Bournemouth? They had a takeover, so they might be itchy trigger fingers, but they've put so much faith in the Spanish fella, the new players. They might try and be a bit more patient there. Some of the other struggles, you look at like Everton, they've got no money. Dash just about kept them up last season. They couldn't afford to sack him even if they wanted to. They've had a couple of good results recently, so it looks like they've maybe turned a corner. But I'm in favour of managers getting more patience. I think it's too easy to just be like, we've lost a few games, let's change the manager. I think if you look at historical Premier League seasons, the teams that have changed managers, it doesn't necessarily lead to any improvement anyway. So you spend a lot of money sacking a manager and a lot of money bringing in a new manager, and it doesn't necessarily make any difference. Historically, the correlation between wage bills and finishing position is extremely, extremely close. I know we all like to think that managers can make a big difference, but it's tends to be marginal gains, really, at most clubs. It's as simple as how much money are you spending on the players, and that tends to correspond to the league position. Broadly speaking, obviously, there's the odd outlier. But yeah, I think I wouldn't be surprised if Bournemouth did make the change over the break. It's entirely down to Kev.
Yeah, I think I had a look at the table today, and I think when you go down it, there's just not really any surprises. There hasn't been, I think on sort of both sides of it, really, there's not really that surprise package towards the top of the table. There's not really anyone who you think is struggling massively towards the bottom. And as sort of Jamie says, you know, that the promoted sides are usually the ones that you're looking at to maybe make some sort of knee-jerk reaction really early into the season after having a very bad start. But I think increasingly with some, especially with a couple of the sides that got promoted this season, you know, Luton, for example, you get the impression that some of the teams that get promoted and don't have the same, just don't have the resources to necessarily compete with everyone else in the Premier League. They're quite happy to, you know, spend that season there, do as well as they can, take those riches, go back to the, down to the Championship stronger and have another crack at it and try and get back into it the following year. And, you know, use those riches that come with being in the Premier League to improve everything else associated with the club. And that's kind of the impression I'm getting with Luton. And for that reason, I kind of think that, you know, Rob Edwards, whatever happens, he's going to be there until the end of this campaign because he's proved already that you can get them out of the Championship. You know, you look at Burnley, like Jamie said, a few people kind of expected them to maybe have a better start to the season, but they've had such a tough run of fixtures that I'm not sure anyone really knows quite how good they are yet. And obviously Company has quite a lot of goodwill from the way essentially completely transformed the way Burnley played last year. So I think people are still kind of excited to see how they get on under him once, you know, perhaps a more winnable run of fixtures comes along. And yeah, as Jamie said, Heckenbottom's kind of the one that you look at. You know, maybe even, I don't know, they seem to be shipping goals for fun at the moment. They've got 1 point as well as Bournemouth. Maybe they're the ones that might look at this international break as an opportunity for a change. again, as James said, if you can survive that Newcastle result, then maybe he's going to be around for a while. And I think, just more broadly speaking, I think the ones that maybe coming into the season that people were tipping to go, I think David Moyes was one that people had talked about for a while. I've never understood this, but a lot of West Ham fans that I've spoken to have, towards the end of last season especially, just weren't very happy with David Moyes. And you got the impression that pressure would build on him a little bit if they didn't start the season well. But, you know, they have started the season well. They're well in the top half. They've had some really good results. Seem to have rediscovered the league form that maybe deserted them a little bit last year. And have also been getting on well in Europe. And then similarly, I guess maybe another one that you'd look at was Ange at Tottenham. You know, a lot of people, no one necessarily except for maybe Celtic fans, no one expects him to do as well as he has done so far. And if he had got off to a difficult start, then people might have been looking at him as one. Similarly, Gary O'Neill has started picking up some points at Wolves after a difficult start. And then Sean Dyche, who Jamie mentioned, has managed to get a couple of results with Everton recently. And there's also, they probably can't afford to sack him anyway. So that's maybe why he'll be in the job a little bit longer. I don't think it is a massive surprise that we haven't seen anyone get sacked yet. I think in a very strange way, the Premier League's going sort of according to form so far this campaign. So not massively surprised that no one's gone, but also on the back of us discussing this, wouldn't be surprised if someone goes in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I agree with the idea that, you know, teams this early are basically living up to or down to the expectations that we all had of them. So I think that's right. No matter how bad things get for the three promoted teams, I really can't see any of their managers getting the chop, certainly before Christmas, but as you say, probably running the course of the season. In part, I think also because there's a shared responsibility across the organization about how the individual clubs prepared for the upcoming season. And if you're going to take responsibility as the board for why you're failing at a higher level, then that part of that failure is going to reflect on you, not just on the manager. So I don't think we've reached the tipping point just yet beyond how difficult everyone really expected the season to be, or we haven't got to a point where it's too early for any team to be terminally detached. So I don't think there's going to be that knee-jerk reaction. But also, I mean, you know, to an extent, the same goes for whoever might be the first manager to lose their job. It's not so much whether it's too early to make a change. I think it depends on factors that are not always within the club's control. I mean, like, who else is out there? Who else is available, for example? It's not just, you know, change for change's sake can actually work. The new manager bounce doesn't always arrive, and it can work in reverse and instill panic in a team, you know? So there's also, you know, the consideration of, you know, if you change the manager and the management structure and you go to the expense of getting rid of your existing coach and bringing in a new coaching staff, how does the club ownership, how prepared are the club ownership to change the trajectory of what was clearly going wrong, whether that's happening off the pitch, which you know, is just as important as the team's form on it. So I think there are so many factors, as both of you guys said. Certainly the expectations for the promoted teams were exactly how they're playing out to a certain extent. So I don't think there's an incentive at the moment for any of the lower teams to make a change for the reasons that you guys articulately pointed out.
Gotcha. Yeah, obviously great points from all of you, especially the fact that it's my fault if anything happens over this international break. We'll take a quick break and then we'll be back with club-specific questions for each of our guests.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, and we are back. Jamie, we'll start off with you talking about the Burnley match. There may have been some confidence heading into this one since Chelsea had been struggling, but obviously a sizable defeat. Well, what did you make of the match, and were you surprised by the result?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there was a lot more positivity going into this one, having won at Luton in the week. That was such a big game, getting that first win of the season. It felt like a bit of a weight had been lifted, really. And especially the manner of it. We showed such character to get the winner about a minute after Luton had equalised and they'd had so much pressure, it felt like that goal was coming. So then go down the other end and score straight away and then hold on to win. It really felt like a sort of marker for our season. So to then have essentially the same defeat that we've had at home 3-4 times already this season, really, really disappointing. The tricky thing with the home performance is that we seem to start games quite well, but as soon as things start going against us, heads begin to drop a bit. The mentality is not very good. We seem to lose belief very quickly. And the upsetting thing for me about Saturday's game was that Chelsea didn't even have to play that well. They're still in the bottom half of the table. They're not a very good team yet. They've got all these talented young players who might develop and gel, but they haven't yet. And we made it far too easy for them, really. Raheem Sterling looked like he had an incredible game on paper. He wasn't that good. And I like Sterling. I rate him highly. I think he's a very good player and should still be in the England squad. I don't really understand why they've moved on from him. But we made him look like a world beater. There were some real curious decisions from Vincent Kompany. And this is becoming a bit of a trend as well. He made 4 changes to the team, having won at Luton, which in itself seems odd, but a couple of them seem to be rotation more than players being dropped. And if you're resting players going into an international break, I just don't think that makes any sense whatsoever. I couldn't get my head around the team when I saw it, and the way they were lining up, I just didn't understand it. We had Vitinho playing at right back for the first time, I think, this season, and Sterling just ran him ragged all game. I think he took him on in the first 5 minutes. Vitinho dived in, completely missed the ball and the player, and he just set the tone for the afternoon. There was no surprise that the first goal came from Vitinho allowing Sterling to run at him. Then he gave away the penalty for the second, and after that, the game's essentially over. The other concern I have about Kompany, other than that he's making all these changes and it's that people are saying it's a bit roulette and Tom Ball were team selections, it just seemed random who's on the team sheet week in, week out. The fact that we start second halves so badly, every game it seems like the opposition come out of the traps really well after the break and we're just really sluggish. I've lost count of the number of games that we've lost in the 5, 10, 15 minute period after the second half's got started. And also when we make substitutions, when things are going wrong, we get even worse. It's really concerning for me. We talked on the show before about the play style and whether there's a need to be a bit more pragmatic, but the concern for me right now is that Kompany's wedded to this play style of the slow possession football, playing it out from the back. It was so successful last season at a lower level when we hammered everyone in the Championship, won promotion easily. A lot harder in the Premier League and our players are worse. Our defence is worse. Our goalkeeper's worse. We signed players to play centre-back who aren't very good at playing it out from the back. It just all seems a bit confused right now, but the fixture list hasn't been kind, so maybe when we play the teams around us, like Luton, maybe things will be different.
Yeah, you touched on both sides of the pitch, which was where I was going to go next, because you currently have the second lowest shots on target, fourth lowest goals scored, and the second most goals conceded. Seems like a pretty comprehensive issue, but as you say, do you think that is largely the people that you've played, or like you said, maybe they're not being a firm plan as to what the identity should be, since the way you were playing last year isn't bringing the results that one would have hoped?
I think it's a mixture. I think it's still quite a small sample size, right? We've only played a handful of games. The home games, we've lost them all, but they've been against teams that are going to be at the top. We've played Spurs, Villa, Manchester United, Chelsea, Man City. So arguably they're five of what's likely to be, what, the top six, top eight, depending on if Man United get that together. So it's been tough. We've got a lot of young players, so I think the plan is that they're going to adapt and get used to the Premier League and develop and improve and just settle in time. Personally, I think we're playing too many young players, but that's certainly what company seems to be gambling on. But I'm really hopeful that there's a bit of a rethink over the international break. I think we've got too many young players in the team at the same time. You mentioned there the attacking statistics. We actually look quite good going forward. I think our best player this season has probably been Lyle Foster, even though he had that three-match ban. He scored three Premier League goals, I think, had one very harshly ruled out as well at Nottingham Forest, which is the game he got sent off. So Foster really looks the part for me as a Premier League striker. The problem is that we've not really created enough chances. The supporting cast isn't really kicking on yet. The midfield doesn't protect the defence well enough. And like I mentioned, the goalkeeper's a downgrade on the one that we had last year for me. So I think there's a couple of obvious changes for Kompany to make over the break. One, he can play Aaron Mirich, who was our goalkeeper last season, did a fantastic job. I'm not really sure why he's decided James Trafford is an improvement, because there's no evidence to suggest that he is. And I think we need more experience in midfield. So although it feels like my answer to when everything's ongoing right is play Jack Cork, my answer is play Jack Cork and have a bit of ballast in the midfield and a leader, and someone who's going to make sure that the heads of those young players doesn't start to drop when things start going against us.
Gotcha. Well, yeah, hopefully things turn around for you, because we like you around here and we want to make sure you're up for the Premier League again next season. Hopefully you just get some wins. It must be very jarring after the roughly infinite wins that you had last season that this season they just aren't coming as much. All right, Sam, we'll come on to you next to talk about Crystal Palace. Probably would have been more fun to talk about the win against United last week, so apologies from a scheduling perspective. But the other big thing to talk about has to be all the injuries that are going on at the moment. Obviously leads to a 0-0 draw against Nottingham Forest, but just curious your thoughts on why you've suffered so much in the injury department and when and if things will get better.
Yeah, I think it's up for a lot of Palace fans. The reason's fairly obvious. It was an incredibly thin squad coming into the new season, and it's obviously even thinner now. I think Sky Sports put up a graphic yesterday of all the injuries, and if you went down it, there's probably five or six players in there out of the 11 that were listed that you could make an argument for that they'd be starting for us. Really, you know, so obviously Eze, Elise, Joe Ward, another one, Jefferson Lerma, Mateus Franco, who we signed in the summer, kind of pitched by some people to be the Zaha replacement. Whether that's true, I don't know, but he obviously would have added a little bit more attacking impetus, which we've been severely lacking. And I think that's been impacted the way that we've had to set up recently. You know, our last two home games have been Fulham and Nottingham Forest, and both of those games have been 0-0 draws, and we've essentially had to go into those games to sit back, soak up pressure and try to hit them on the counter-attack, which is probably more what you would associate with the away team doing. But I think given the players that we have available to us, that's kind of what we've had to do. I mean, Hudson Edouard came back in yesterday. He's our top scorer of the season, but even he's been rushed back from a hamstring injury, didn't look fit at all. We managed to win at Old Trafford, as you mentioned last week, somehow, with a front three of Jordan Ayew, Jean-Philippe Mateta and Jeffrey Schlupp. And I think if you asked any Palace fan to name their preferred front three, Ayew is perhaps the only one out of those who would appear on some occasions, definitely not all. So I think to have got to 12 points from seven games, to have only lost at home to Arsenal and away to Villa, is, given all of those injuries, is a pretty solid return. It's even more impressive to kind of be unbeaten in those last three, given that's when the injury crisis has really started to set in. It hasn't been pretty at all, as I mentioned, with Fulham and Forest. But yeah, it does very much feel like our hands are tied at the moment, and there is only one way that we're able to play. And I think in terms of the reasons for those injuries, it is quite interesting. I mean, our injury record under Vieira wasn't that bad, and before that, I do seem to remember players being injured under Hodgson a little bit more often. So whether the way he sets us up is a little, there's sort of more wear and tear, for want of a better phrase. But I think it just comes back to the size of the squad, really. Like, I think Matt Wisdom at The Athletic tweeted yesterday that we've used 18 players this season, which is the least out of any other side in the league, which speaks to, which goes back to like the summer transfer activity, really. We lost a lot of players. We lost Zaha, who was obviously the most important one, and we only signed 4. And out of those, only Lerma has really featured regularly so far. And I think it's a bit of a shame, really, because at the end of last season, I think we saw that Hodgson wasn't here just to play negative football. When Elise, Eze, Edouard were all fit, we played some pretty exciting stuff. So to have lost all of those, it's meant that he's had to revert to type a little bit, or at least the type people associate with the Roy Hodgson team the most, in order for us to keep the points tally ticking over. And in all honesty, I think a lot of people feel quite sorry for him, because it's definitely not what he would have signed up for. I think when we announced in the summer that he'd be staying on, all of the quotes from both Hodgson and Steve Parrish, the chairman, were about the squad probably being good enough for a top 10 finish. That was kind of a good maybe month or few weeks before the transfer window shut. And I think when Hodgson said that, he probably thought we'd be making a few more signings and probably wouldn't be as affected by injuries as we have been. I think most fans are kind of sympathetic with the circumstances. And most of the frustration hasn't actually been directed at Hodgson and the way that we're playing, but rather probably at the owners for what was really a pretty lacklustre summer. You know, we needed reinforcements in some really obvious areas. We didn't make them, and it's kind of been a familiar story for us since we got promoted to the Premier League, to be honest, in that we sort of go through the motions during transfer windows. Like every club, we'll get linked to a lot of players. That one or two signings are close, but we'll kind of walk away from the negotiating table because the deal doesn't quite suit us, and we kind of hedge our bets on having a thin squad and just hoping that the best players within that aren't going to get injured. But eventually that kind of catches up with you, and I think that's been the case this season. It does lead to some pretty ugly situations, like the ones we have at the moment. So I think, yeah, over the next couple of weeks of international break, we'll really be hoping that some of those players make a bit of a miraculous recovery, because so many of the injuries as well were sort of hamstrings, muscular injuries that it's quite difficult to put a time frame on, and not the type of injury where you'd want to rush someone back. So yeah, fingers crossed the international break, we're able to get a few of those players back to fitness and see a bit of a stronger side than we did yesterday.
Yeah, and I'm sure you're really wanting to get those players back, since the first two after the break are Newcastle and Tottenham, and then obviously Jamie's mighty Burnley. So yeah, you're gonna need some players back for that. But like you said, hamstring injuries are just so persistent, where if they don't get fully right, it's just so easy to have a recurrence of that injury. So I guess I just hope that you guys make the right call with that type of injury. We will wrap up the club section with Steve. A very eloquent question for myself, but we couldn't, could we?
I was waiting for that. It depends what you mean by the question, Kev, and I think there are several scenarios, several things that can play out in that answer. Could we win the league this year? I don't think so, but why not? We're certainly in the mix for top four, and deservedly so, I think, but there's still two or three teams, definitely two, probably three teams better and deeper than us that are probably a better bet for the title, and a lot is going to depend on how deep they go into the Champions League. So that's that question. Could we be better than we have been the past few schizophrenic seasons? We already are. Could we learn from this season, adapt from this season, and build on what seems to be a really powerful and potent relationship between this great new manager that we have and his players? Absolutely. If you don't believe that, you're not a Spurs fan. I absolutely think that the only way is up from here. Could we play with style and confidence in a way that that almost makes me agree with those of my friends who say, we've got our Tottenham back. Kev, I've got to tell you, I said to Patrick the other day, my friend Patrick, who's been on your show, it might even be that we needed Harry to leave to free up this, give the freedom to the rest of the squad and let them come through. And Ange, I think, it's early days. We're 8 games into the season, but he seems like the missing piece. He seems like the sort of manager that is capable of getting performances out of players that we knew were deep in there somewhere, but we just couldn't see them. So it might be the turning point when we lost Harry, that it was necessary. It was a necessary step to rebuild and reset this team. Could we win the league this season? I don't think so, but it's going to be fun watching us try.
Yeah, the Harry point is an interesting one. I remember tweeting out when at the fan forum, Levy did confirm that there is actually a buyback in Harry Kane's deal, which I was shocked by because it seemed like Bayern were either willing to go up to the price we were asking without a buyback clause or pay about 20 million less than we were asking and include one. And we ended up actually getting both. And yeah. I very excitedly was like, wow, that's like great business from Levy. And, you know, the fact that we can bring him back when we want to is great. And it got a very tepid response. Do you think that's partially because of, like, what you're saying? That, like, this new era that we're already feeling, albeit just 8 games in from a Premier League context, that people are just feeling like, yeah, we are playing better. The opponents don't know as much what we are going to do. It isn't just lump it up to Kane, which I'm sure would have been the strategy in a match like Luton yesterday. And so people are more interested in where this project is going than, you know, bringing back our all-time leading goal scorer.
Having said that, though, as we were talking about in the previous question about which manager might get sacked first, there was actually a point at which a lot of money was on before the league started. A lot of money was on Ange to be the first to get the chop. So in a way, I think what Levy was doing with the buyback was just hedging, just a straight hedge. Can we pick this back up again? Harry is a globally recognized strike force player that you know what you're going to get with him. So why would we not take the opportunity to bring him back? Now, it might be we're at a point where Ange doesn't want him back. You know, if we're and we'll leave the Richarlison question aside for just a moment because we're going to come on to a player discussion. But if Ange is able to take the spirit that he has in this team without Harry, and then add Harry back to it, he's risking upsetting that dynamic completely. And I think that would be a detrimental situation for both of them. I'm not sure. I mean, Harry wants to turn the page as well. I'm not sure Harry would want to come back to a scenario where and I don't know about the rest of the Spurs fans, but I want to win the league without Harry. I really do. I mean, Harry's legacy at Spurs is already assured, but I want to be seen to be a team without him. I want to be seen to be a good team without him. And I think we're heading in that direction. Do I think we're ready to win the league this year? No. But I think we're positioning ourselves to be there or thereabouts for the next couple of seasons. So. But the Harry question is a very interesting one, and you're absolutely on nail on the head about the buyback clause.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if not to make a comparison to a club that we don't have much love for, but it feels like this year's Tottenham could be somewhat similar to last year's Arsenal, and if you manage to get into the top 4 or top 5, depending on how all that lands. Being able to bring back one of the best strikers in the world it's not a bad option to have, especially, as you say, with depth probably being the biggest issue. Yes. Son can't play more than 60 minutes of football right now. We've seen Richarlison not exactly bury his chances. So striker may certainly be a position that we may be in need of in future years.
But would Harry want to come back? I'm not convinced.
Great question. One that we'll have to deal with another day, but we will wrap up with Player Watch. We're just curious from your sides if there's a player at your club that you've been a little disappointed with thus far that you thought would maybe be able to help out more than they have thus far.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned him a couple of times already, and I feel bad for the lad because he's made such a big jump. James Trafford was playing League One football last season, and now we're asking him to play in the Premier League. Fair enough, over the summer he won the under 21 European Championships with England and was the hero in the final, saved a penalty. But at the moment, I'm not seeing anything to suggest he was worth the large fee that we paid for him. And the fee's not his fault, so I have sympathy with him. But last season, Aaron Muric had so much improvement over the course of the season. The start of the season, he was a bit ropey, he made mistakes. But he developed so much, and he's such a character as well. I think the fans really talk to him. He's a bit of a cult hero. And for him to lose his place to... Trafford's essentially a kid. Who, like I said, was playing two leagues below last season. It's a big, big jump, and it looks it so far. It looks a bit out of his depth.
And you just handed him the starting job, right? There wasn't like a battle for it?
No, not at all. So the way I saw it at the start of the season was that Muric would probably start with all the pressure on him to keep his place, and as soon as he made a mistake, he'd be out. And although it would have been harsh, I think you could have understood it if Muric should have started with the gloves, and then it had been they're yours to lose, and if you lose them, fair enough. But the fact Trav had started, and over pre-season, Muric had arguably outperformed him, I don't think it was really fair. I think it sets a pretty poor message to Muric and some of the other players from the Champions team who've been pushed aside a little bit by the new signings. I think we should have probably started with more of the team that was successful last season. But the main issue is that Trafford just hasn't shown the skill set to play company system. We spent all this money, and the fee's not his fault. I always keep caveating with it's not his fault that we decided it was worth nearly £20 million, even though he never played above League One. One of the most expensive goalkeepers of all time, even though he's so young. He doesn't have the range of passing needed to play, not just in company system, to be fair, but in the Premier League. Almost every team now plays it out from the back, right? And you keep it and you keep it and you wait for them to press and then you play it over the top. That's how it works. You need the medium and long range passing from the goalkeepers in order to make that work. Trafford doesn't have it. He just doesn't have it. And yes, he's young and he might get better, but right now he's nowhere near ready. He's nowhere near ready. So for me, that's the most obvious change to make in the team. And he's not on his own. A lot of the new signings haven't really done it yet. And I've suggested on Twitter /X/ whatever it's called this week that some of them might be duds. I think it's maybe harsh to call Trafford a dud when he's come with such a big reputation and the pedigree of coming from Man City and England under 21s and all that. He's got this tag of being a future England number one, but there's been absolutely nothing to suggest he's that player yet.
Yeah, I think at Palace, he actually went off injured yesterday. But a lot of Palace fans would probably say Jeffrey Schlupp is the player they've been most disappointed with thus far. Now, in an ideal world, I think 30-year-old Jeffrey Schlupp, who was signed under Sam Allardyce, probably wouldn't be starting for us in 2023. But that's where we have been for the first 8 games of the season because of the injury crisis, because of the lack of summer transfer window activity. And unfortunately for Jeffrey Schlupp, the position he's been playing in for the most part is the position that was vacated by Wilfried Zaha. So it's not really a fair comparison, but like, man, he's been really, really bad. You can usually rely on Schlupp to do a job. I think over the past few seasons, we've probably used him more in midfield, and he has been fairly good at sort of making runs beyond the striker, being a bit of a goal threat. And you can usually rely on him being a sort of solid 6 out of 10, really. And whether it's been Hodgson or Vieira before that, you know, managers seem to trust him and like to use him. But it does feel a little bit like we've been carrying him in the first 8 games of the season. You know, he hasn't been creating chances. He hasn't been threatening in the forward areas. You don't really notice he's on the pitch until he's subbed off after about 70 minutes. And despite all the injuries, despite how desperate we are for players at the moment, we were a much better team when he went off yesterday and was replaced by Jez Rakzaki, who's a youngster from the academy. I think I'd say Schlupp, and he's kind of become a bit of a lightning rod, really, for the frustrations that some Palace fans do have with that summer window that I talked about earlier, and the frustrations that some fans do have with the owners. A lot of people don't really think he should be anywhere near the starting 11, and also sort of see him blocking the path of some of our academy products, despite the fact that he hasn't been performing. When we've had a fairly solid start to the season and most players have performed fairly well, he's probably been the one negative that a lot of people would point to.
As for Spurs, Kev, I'll be honest, and I'll say generally there hasn't been one player that I've been disappointed with or disappointed even to see their name in the lineup, which you know we've talked about in the past is something that characterizes how people look at Spurs and Spurs lineups in recent years. Every player, I think, is in the process of adapting to the manager's system, and it's bringing even more out of players we already knew were capable of good things. And I think Kulusevski particularly is benefiting from that. Players, you know, for sure have off games, and certainly Richarlison has struggled a little more than we would have hoped, I think. But he's first and foremost a confidence player. I mean, those two early chances that he had in yesterday's game, for example, I mean, if one of those goes in, and arguably he should have scored both of them, but one of those goes in, he has a completely different game. And of course, within the context, of course, his honesty in talking about his psychological issues, I think that'll only help him just getting it out in the open and talking about it publicly. Maybe I might have expected a little more impact off the bench from Manor Solomon, but now, you know, he's going to be out for a period and he'll have to start again from the bottom of the pile. So I definitely feel for him. But, you know, by the same token, we have Rodrigo Betancourt come back into the team relatively soon, one of our best players last season. So you get the sense that the entity that is the team, that is the squad, is healing itself almost in a way. As a one-off, in terms of disappointment, I was disappointed with how Bissouma picked up that red card yesterday. Uncharacteristically stupid of him, and I hope he learned something from it, and I have a feeling Ange will definitely have said something similar to him. Generally, I think the team's in a place where the feeling of winning and playing relatively well is lifting all the boats. And in terms of what we were talking about in the previous question, in terms of building a post-Kane identity for this Spurs team, it really helps that the burden's being shared, you know, across a whole number of players, not just falling on one or two. So, you know, for example, the combination of Romero and Van de Ven, and with Vicario stepping up the way he has, I mean, that sends as much confidence through the rest of the team when they're on the same page as when Kane and Son were combining the way they did. And even if the end result isn't being measured in goals and assists, and I think that's the important thing, We're not really going to judge this team on where they finish this year. We're going to judge them on how they're playing, how well they're playing, how well they're gelling together, and how well they're responding to Postecoglou. So in terms of disappointments, very, very, very few. I'm happy to be able to say that.
Gotcha. Well, we'll wrap things up there. So if you guys would like to tell folks where they could find you or anything you're working on, now would be a good time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, as always. It's been a pleasure. I write about Burnley for the No Name Never newsletter, which goes out via Substack. It's free to subscribe. I'll post the link on Twitter as well, so you can get me there at Jamie Smith Sport.
Cheers, Kev. Thanks for having me back on. Always good to hear the views of Jamie and Steve as well. I've been Sam Karp, and for anyone who wants to follow me on Twitter, you can get me at Sam_Karp.
Thanks again, Kevin. That was another fun discussion. Thanks, guys. And my name's Steve McGookin. You can get me on Twitter at Steve McGookin. And if you want to read my non-football writing. It's at statesofplayproject.com. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'm your host, Kevin DeVries. You can find me on that one website at Kevroff and the show at EPL Roundtable. And you can also find the show by searching EPL Roundtable in any of your podcast clients. But huge thanks to these three for coming on today and putting up with whatever's going on in my brain. And folks at home, we hope you keep listening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.